And we are waiting, actually, for a representative would like to testify on the first bill, which is House Bill 2876. But just wanted to let you know that House Bill 2018, the work session is going to be held over till later in the week. And
do I need to open up and close the work session?
Yeah. And also, Senate Bill 838A, and we posted that for several other days for work sessions, so that will not be today either. Somebody has their phone on, and we need to ask everybody to turn off their cell phones, BlackBerries, please, because it interferes with our audio equipment. Thank you. So I'm going to open up the public hearing on House Bill. I might as well go ahead and open up the public hearing on House Bill 2876. And Kat, why don't you give us the introduction now? This is the Dash 1 amendments, is that correct?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2876, as originally drafted, directs the State Department of Energy to investigate means to reduce energy consumption in state-owned or state-funded buildings and school district buildings. However, there is an amendment that's a gut and stuff, the Dash 1 amendment, and I think Representative Witt is going to walk us through that.
Great. Representative Witt, would you like to come up to the podium? And also, I think Stephen Cafori. Is Stephen here?
I am.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome, Representative. Thanks for dodging out of revenue for a few minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Brad Witt, State Representative from House District 31. Certainly appreciate your holding a hearing on House Bill 2876, and I'm here in support of that bill and its efforts to save energy in state buildings. In fact, the goal being 20% by the year 2015 over year 2000 levels. Broadly speaking, the bill is an effort to save energy and thereby reduce carbon emissions and helping the state of Oregon to do our part in terms of curbing things like global warming and to reduce our dependence on foreign energy sources. The bill does all of these things through the use of, as it outlines, energy audits, energy management and control measures, capital improvements, operations and maintenance procedures, and energy savings performance contracts. And Mr. Cafori will be telling you more about that here in a moment. It does this by utilizing these instruments whenever a new building is built or an existing one is renovated, and does so under the direction of professional engineers, licensed architects, or other persons pre-qualified by our state's Department of Energy, and it does so using reasonable and cost-effective measures such as conservation, instant gratification, and alternative energy systems. And with that, Madam Chair, I certainly once again appreciate your hearing this bill, and Mr. Cafori is in possession of all the details.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to stay for a little while, or do you have to run back to your committee?
I should probably run back.
Okay.
So.
Thank you for introducing us. We appreciate your foresight.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here today representing Johnson Controls, Incorporated. Johnson Controls is the 85th biggest company in the country. It makes largely auto parts. The part of the company that I work for is involved with energy conservation with government. Introducing this bill, I want to let you know that the amendments to the bill were a product of a work group. Department of Energy was involved. The Governor's Sustainability Office was involved. The Clean and Fair Energy Coalition, Hossberg, AFL-CIO, and my client. It's a relatively simple bill. There are two general directives. First, to state agencies, it requires state agencies that own their own facilities have to reduce energy consumption, as Representative Witt said, 20% by the year 2015. But it's not just a pie in the sky kind of, we hope you do this. There is a requirement they must prepare a plan by January 2009 to examine and evaluate their options, establish a timeline, establish interim goals, so that we know what's happening, not only just a few days before 2015 comes around, we say, did you guys actually do it or not, but there's a plan of developing now what you're going to be doing and evaluating that and reporting that so the Department of Energy knows what's going on with state agencies. They say the other part is they must report their energy use to the state agencies. So that this will be there. This is happening to some extent now, but it's not universal. Not all state agencies are presently reporting how much energy they're using. This will mandate that they all do that. It further directs the Department of Energy to pre-qualify vendors for energy audits and energy qualification programs. This would be companies like my own, and there are a number of other companies similar in the state of Oregon, some large, some small. They do this conservation work. That these people would be pre-qualified and placed on a list so that it would speed up the selection process, so we don't have to have years and years, as it sometimes goes, selecting people for complex projects. One other thing I want to do is take a minute to explain, which I think is a really important concept, Madam Chair, and that is energy savings performance contracts. One of the methods that will be used to achieve these goals of energy conservation are the energy savings performance contracts. They're defined in the ORS. My client, Johnson Controls, and several other companies, some, I'd say, large, Chevron, Siemens, Electronics, do this kind of work, and there are some smaller Oregon companies that do it as well, offer a combination of services and products for energy retrofitting of buildings and other facilities. Department of Energy has financing options for funding these projects, and you're going to hear when the Department of Energy comes a little more detail. I'm sure you've also in other bills heard about the funding options from the Department of Energy for energy conservation. But the difference is, and what I'm offering is an energy conservation, energy savings performance contract, is that the companies guarantee the energy savings for a period of years. It can be 5, 10, 15 years, some places even longer. With the result that the entire cost of the contract, the audit, the design, the installation, the cost of the product, and the cost of financing are all subsumed in the energy savings, and that the company guarantees that savings. And as a matter of fact, Madam Chair, because of the fact that we're guaranteeing huge savings over a long period of time, and if those are not met, we have to write a check back to the public agency, we're very cautious in our estimates. And as a result, about 80% of our clients actually achieve cash back. They'll get 20 to 30% more energy cost savings. So this is not only a way to save energy, it's also a way to get money back into state agencies that we know are desperately short during these days. That's my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Corey. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. Good seeing you, Mr. Kapori. Thank you for bringing this forward. I guess I just need a little bit of clarification on Section 2, Item 2. I guess I'm about to really show my ignorance on this. Authorized state agency means any state agency, board, commission, department, or division that is authorized to finance the construction, purchase, or renovation of buildings or other structures to be used by the state of Oregon. It was my understanding, and I guess I need clarification on this, that DAS is the legal body within the state of Oregon that authorizes the finance of construction, purchase, or renovation of buildings. So is this limiting this just to DAS?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, no. There are, this is, of course, existing language here. There are agencies that are authorized to do their own work, of course, and the exact relationship what they have with DAS, I think the Department of Energy can give a better example of that. DAS is involved in a lot of this. But what this means is these are large agencies. Now, the Board of, say, Dental Examiners doesn't have authority to go out and build their own buildings. Department of Corrections does. Now, they don't have authority all by themselves. They have to bring this to the legislature, and there are checks on who does this.
So this is existing statutory
language. This is existing statutory language. What we're saying is this applies to those agencies which presently have their own facilities.
It's just my understanding from serving on Ways and Means. Another question, Madam Chair. On page 5 At the top, lines 1 through, I guess, 15 or 14, it talks about the plan of attack, if you will. Who do you envision in each of these agencies or departments carrying out this work, and how do you envision them paying for the workload that's going to be placed upon them?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, these large agencies already have facilities managers. I don't think this may be a little bit of additional work, but they're, and it's, to some extent, they're doing this now. I'm sure that if you asked most state agencies, are you doing any energy conservation work, they would all say, yes, we're doing some. What we're trying to do is to systematize this. I don't anticipate that there would have to be new staff hired for this project.
So you don't anticipate any fiscal with this?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, no.
Okay. Well, and we'll bring the Department of Energy up to also address that.
Okay. Well, just a quick comment on this. I guess we'll all have our reasons for perhaps for supporting this. In mine, I think there's a business case for why we would adopt House Bill 2876 as amended. In business, there's only two ways to increase your net income, and that's either to raise your revenue or to reduce your expenses. And that same rule applies in government. If there's an opportunity for the state of Oregon to reduce its expenses and allow those dollars to be placed in other areas with a higher and better use, then we ought to be doing that. And so I commend you for bringing House Bill 2876 as amended forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Corey? Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Corey. Would this apply to school districts as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, an interesting political question. Last week it did. This week it doesn't.
Okay, thank you. And
my phone. Wait till next week.
My other question is, we've had a lot of conversation in this committee about the potential cost savings of energy conservation and upgrading, and it's often difficult, and it appears difficult, to figure out what those cost savings might be, and there's a lot of good work that goes into making those estimates. But I'm curious if you know how the company you represent estimates over, say, a 5 or 10 or 20-year period, that payback period, the difference between energy costs under the, you know, retrofitted building versus had the work not been done. And, you know, one of the challenges, it seems like, is just estimating, given, you know, the uncertainty in the energy market. It's hard to predict 5 or 10 years from now what energy will cost. So can you provide any insight into that?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, first thing I tell you is that in the next 10 or 15 years, energy costs are not going to go down. And as a result of this bill, the savings will increase. We do, in my business, a kind of a rough and then a more detailed examination of conservation savings. The first thing that happens is we go into a building is we take a look at just a rough how many dollars per square foot does this facility use in energy consumption. And our folks from that simple number can get a rough idea of what the energy savings are. The second step then is to work with the staff at a facility to do a much more detailed audit. And that's a walk through the building, examining, looking at the facility, looking at the systems that are being used, and reviewing in more detail the record of energy consumption. We do a lot of this all over the United States, and so we know what that can be. The next step is to sit down with the staff from that place and say, after our 2-3 month examination, we can say there are 50 things we could do to save you energy. And then we can talk about the payback on these. Changing your windows might be a 15-year payback. Changing your boiler might be a 3-year payback. And the beauty of the energy savings performance contracts is we can roll this all into one contract. So things that otherwise might take too long, like a 15-year payback for windows, we can roll that in with a 3-year savings on the boiler, put that into one contract, and get your maximum energy conservation savings.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to ask the Department of Energy to come up. Betty Merrill is here. And then also I'll ask Bob Shipwreck to come up at the same time. Yep, just so we can move things along. But Betty, you can get started. I think there was a question. I don't know if you also have testimony, but we have some questions that probably
the department.
Madam Chairman, committee, I think I'll start with a statement. We are in support of this bill. What this bill fundamentally does is add new energy efficiency specifications to the existing state energy efficient design program. The program currently states a 10% savings by 2003 by state agencies. This ups it another 10% by 2015. We collect data from each agency annually. This year, DAS, we created a database, modified a database, and each agency will go online and enter their total energy use. So that's how we're tracking how they're doing against the targets. And this program's been in place for a number of years. We do both new buildings are required to have a 20% energy savings over existing code, and on the existing building side, we're monitoring their energy use every year and comparing it. So I'll take questions.
Okay. Representative Smith, did you want to?
I thought that. Thank you. That answered my question.
Good question.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. I would just like to follow up on as far as, so this program has already been in place. You're expanding it. This would not put additional burden on agencies who to meet this extended goal?
You know, the agencies have been reporting the data on spreadsheets. We've made it easier for them to go online and enter that data. In terms of making a plan for those agencies who haven't met the goal yet, we'll be working with them to develop a plan for how they'll be able to get to those savings.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the department? Okay. Mr. Shipra?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building Trades Council. And I've been waiting all session to testify on this bill. This is a very good bill. In the construction industry, we have evolved to a lot of Oregon contractors who are now in the energy business, and which means Oregon workers. There are tremendous energy savings to be made due to just to the new technology and the fact that we have a lot of old buildings. It affects a lot of the different crafts, specifically, however, electricians, pipe fitters, plumbers, sheet metal workers, but even the window installers, insulation. Some of the savings that are realized are simple things such as just, a lot of you know, changing out the ballasts and the tubes of fluorescent fixtures or going to fluorescent or halogen lights, things like that. Low energy motors that we now have, they use much less. And then that whole area of cost savings just in heating water for either heating or for our own personal use, you can save a lot of money there. John Endicott, the business manager of the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters, couldn't be here today. He spent his whole career in this field, and that's what he did for about 25 years. And we talked about the bill, and he says what they figured at their companies that he worked at was about a six-year average of returning your cost was only in about 6 years. In closing, I just want to point out that, in fact, the state has discovered that we can save so much money by doing it, and it is clearly the right thing to do. That you probably may be aware that there's about a $60 million construction job going on at Oregon State University, all of which will be paid back. Those revenue bonds will be paid back just on the savings in energy alone. We'll pay off the $60 million worth of bonds so that we can heat and cool that university where they actually had to close buildings if the temperature got below 30 degrees. So that's my testimony, and I really applaud you bringing this bill forward.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Shipra? Representative Smith?
Actually, Madam Chair, just a quick statement and an observation. It's too bad that we couldn't take the best practices that are learned by these agencies and put those online so business, particularly small business in the state of Oregon, could take advantage of it. And just very quickly, let me give you an example. I had a business back in La Grande that used a tremendous amount of cardboard, tremendous amount, boxes and boxes and boxes of cardboard, ran about $500 a month to dump the cardboard. With a little bit of work, we figured out a compaction system for the cardboard. They were able to compact the stuff, consequently recycle the cardboard, eliminated their landfill bill almost by $500, and provided a benefit both to the environment and to the small business owner. And to me, it seems like we ought to be looking at those best practices throughout the agency so all the state can benefit.
Okay.
Just a thought.
The department's currently working with USDA and some of their rural programs which are working on energy efficiency, so we're helping the USDA outreach group promote energy efficiency in rural areas for businesses and farmers.
But I don't want to get too excited because Jeremy might come support me.
He's up next, so you don't have to worry about that, Representative Smith. But thank you very much for coming and testifying. Okay, Jeremiah and
Jeremy.
Jeff is next. Our last one's up. You made him turn red.
Jeremiah, I apologize.
It's okay, I was Jeremy in high school.
I'm sure he's been called other things as well.
You won't go there. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'll keep this incredibly brief. I have only two things to say. One is that energy conservation should be the option of first resort for reducing our dependence on fossil fuels, for cutting global warming pollution, and for reducing energy costs for consumers, whether that's a residential consumer, a business, or in this case a state agency. And my second thought is that state agencies should absolutely be leading the way, which is exactly where this bill goes, both to lead by example and to be demonstrating best practices, but also because it's a sound investment in the state budget, because we bring down the state government's energy costs and, exactly as Representative Smith has already said, free up money that can be used for other programs in those agencies elsewhere in the budget, or to otherwise put off the need to raise revenue more than is necessary. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Jeff?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, statewide collaboration of consumer groups, environmental organizations, human service agencies, clean energy businesses, faith groups, and labor, testifying in support of House Bill 2876. Basically just need to add a me too, and as we just to note that as we consider a broad range of energy issues this session, particularly on the renewables front, it is good to see that, you know, we're also continuing the commitment to energy efficiency and energy reduction or usage reduction as well, because that is again the cheapest kilowatt hour is the kilowatt hour you don't have to produce in the first place. One of our members, the Northwest Energy Efficiency Council, which is the trade association of energy efficiency companies in the region, primarily Washington and Oregon, asked me to bring their support and encouragement for the bill, and assuming that you, if you pass it out of committee, they'll be sending around a floor letter talking about sort of the impact on the energy efficiency business statewide of this bill. But they're in strong support of the bill, as is the entire coalition. Thank you. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Gentlemen, any questions?
Madam Chair, I'm wondering, really, almost on behalf of Representative Jensen, whether this bill directs state drivers not to exceed 55 miles an hour.
Is yours? Energy efficiency.
Yeah. Representative Cannon, no state building can exceed 50 miles an hour.
Try to make sure we enforce it. Any other questions for the panel? Thank you. Does anybody else want to come up and testify on 2876 before I close the public hearing on that? Okay. That I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2876 and open up a work session.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2876.
Okay. Representative Cannon has moved the dash one amendments or adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 2876. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Okay, seeing none, the dash ones are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2876 as amended to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay, Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2876 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Okay. Motion carries, and House Bill 2876 is amended with the dash ones. Move to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and I was going to suggest that we ask Representative Witt if he would like to carry his bill, unless anyone has a burning desire here. Okay. So with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2876.
I just asked if there was any objections.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure.
Okay. So we close the work session on House Bill 2876, and Representative Witt will be the carrier. Okay, with that, I will open up reopen the public hearing on Water Measurement Bill, which is House Bill 2564. We ran out of time last time, and we're going to really try to move quickly along because we have another full hearing. And Beth Petrino is going to give us a little bit of background, and then I'm going to ask Representative Jensen to give us a summary of the work group discussion. Yeah, give an update on the amendments. Yeah. So the dash two amendments, Beth, you can just give a quick review.
Madam Chair, members, the House Bill 2564-2 amendments accomplish a number of things. What I'd like to do is just briefly go through the sections of the amendment and identify what it is that section does. To begin with, Section 2 directs the Water Resources Department to implement the Strategic Water Measurement Program, and I believe the department's going to briefly describe that program in just a bit. Sections 3 through 9 of the amendment amend various existing water statutes, in most cases to authorize the department to require either measurement or reporting of water use. Section 3 deals with surface water, 4 with groundwater, 5 also with groundwater. 6 again deals with measurement, authorizing the commission to require a water user to report the amount that the commission already has authority to require be measured. Section 7 amends 543.20 to authorize a water master to close a ditch if the reporting requirements of the commission are not complied with. Section 8 again amends current law to authorize the commission to require the owner of a reservoir to install measuring devices and to report. And then finally in Section 9, this is the what's referred to as the SWAMP statute, the Serious Water Management Problem Area statute. And the amendments add in-stream water rights not being met or designation of a waterway as a state scenic waterway or federal wild and scenic river to the list of circumstances which may lead the commission to require water right owners to measure and report water use. Then Section 10 of the amendment establishes a grant program in OWEB to provide funding for measuring devices and gauging stations. Section 11 requires the Water Resources Department to report to the next Legislative Assembly on progress in implementing the Strategic Measurement Program and along with OWEB to assess the success of the grant program. And then Section 12 of the bill sunsets the grant program provisions and the reporting requirements in Sections 10 and 11.
Thank you, Beth. And Bob, if you would be so kind to give us a brief summary of the work group.
Summary of the work group? The work group met on a number of different occasions. We heard from everybody, I think, went around the table a number of times with attitudes, opinions, you know, what people wanted, what they didn't want, what they could live with and what they couldn't live with. One of the things I think that was somewhat apparent when the department came in with their strategic water measurement plan, there was probably more, and I'm basing this not on any kind of a vote that was taken, but more apparent agreement that people could live with the strategic water measurement plan that the commission has set in motion. And as a consequence, it was somewhat the, I think, intention of the chair of this committee when she sought amendments to the original bill that be the tone or of those amendments to put in statute, in essence, an endorsement of the commission's existing policy as far as water measurement is concerned. That is the commission's strategic water measurement policy. I don't know, Madam Chair, I've been more than mildly pessimistic since maybe day one on this whole process, but in light of the fact that the last meeting of the work group, there seemed to be 100% disagreement with the amendments, and that leads me to wonder if maybe we aren't close to where we want to be if nobody can agree that it has any value. So, true pro. With that, I guess you want to have the department maybe explain, walk us through this, or some explanation for the committee on this.
Great, thank you, Representative Jensen. I appreciate your hard work in trying to bring everybody together at the same table, which certainly there was some agreement. There's some disagreement, and that's the way this process seems to work. I'd like to ask the department to come up and just give a brief reminder about the Commission's plan, the Strategic Water Measurement Plan, and then we have a few people who did not get a chance to speak last time that we're going to bring up, of course, on the -2 amendments. Again, we're focusing on those, and we wanted to make sure that those folks who didn't get a chance to come up last time come up. Go ahead, Debbie. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you. Again, for the record, my name is Debbie Colbert with the Water Resources Department, and I'm just providing a handout, which is some of the slides that we used in the work group. One of the first meetings of the work group, Barry Norris and I gave a detailed presentation of our commission's strategic water measurement plan, and if I could just quickly run through the main elements of that strategic measurement plan. First of all, this is an approach that our commission adopted in 2000, and we've been working on implementing it since that time. And the commission first said, well, where are we going to look to increase measurement at existing diversions in the state? And they used watersheds that we had jointly identified with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife as areas under the Oregon plan where we wanted to work, where there were opportunities for flow restoration and the greatest needs for flow restoration from the fish perspective. So those are the areas that we've been focusing in under this effort. The commission also wanted as a strategy to what we call major on the majors. And as you can see, we talk about significant diversions in the third slide of this handout. These are diversions that we consider large, over 5 CFS in those watersheds, or have a large impact on the stream, so take more than 10% of the 50% exceedance flows in the lowest month, or are already required by condition of their permit to measure. These are the diversions that we've been focused on under the strategic plan.
Do you want me to ask a question until she's going to her
wait? Yeah, you can go ahead. I think Representative Jensen has a question.
Yes. I'll have a number of them as Debbie goes through the 1, 2, 3s in the thing. But just very quickly on Section 2, where the language deals with the Water Resource Commission's Strategic Water Measurement Plan. Section 2 is, in fact, considerably broader than what the commission has initially set out, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the intent was to mirror what our commission has already endorsed. I think that there's some ways to adjust these amendments to make it clear that it's endorsing our commission's existing approach. For example, in Section 2, Part 2, it talks about measurement of water use of diversions. You know, to mirror it more closely with what our commission's already set forth, it could say things like water use of significant diversions.
Okay.
So,
that was, I guess part of my question on that one was that what you say is much narrower than the language that's here, which kind of includes every body of water. Including those that aren't even in the state, probably. Thank you, Debbie. That was fine then.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to walk through the rest of these slides quickly. As a result of this strategic effort, we've identified about 2,400 significant diversions across the state in about 290 watersheds included in the printouts of the slides that you have. You can see the distribution of those significant diversions by basin across the state. And then we conclude these slides just by describing our implementation activities. Right now we're focused first on those significant diversions that are out there that are already required by their condition of their right to measure and get them in compliance with those requirements. Our next phase of implementation will be to go in watershed by watershed and work with water users to try to get measurement in place in those areas. And I think that in terms of the amendments and the dash two, a nice link with our commission strategy is the sections establishing a cost share program. We think that this would be a helpful addition to help offset some of the costs for water users that are identified under our commission strategy. And I think that's in the section 10 area of the dash two amendments.
Right. Any other questions for the department?
Bunch of assessment.
Go ahead.
When in section three, Debbie, when it talks about section three, served to amend OS 537-190. Which addresses the terms and conditions associated with the approval of an application to appropriate surface water. And I think the thing refers to you know, 537-190, am I correct on it? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if it might not be more appropriate to put the language in relationship to that in the 537-211, which does have the actual issuance of the conditions for actual issuance of a permit to appropriate surface water.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, we would agree that if the committee was interested in working on further amendments, it would make more sense to put the language in Section 3 in ORS 537-211 rather than ORS 190 as it does in this version.
Thank you. And I think the same thing can be said at another point in the, you know, where we're talking about 537-625 and 537-628 under Section 4. Is that, would you agree with maybe more appropriate there?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, again, we would agree that this is Section 4 is not referencing the best place in statute.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, I I'd just like to have what we're doing as clean as, one of the problems with Oregon water law is it's already pretty convoluted, and to do any more to it may not serve the interests that we really want to serve with it. I don't know. Section 6, there's quite an expansion of the existing law here when we use the term stream, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Representative, you're referring to 543.10, the section 2, where
right.
It talks about along a stream or conveyance structure. I think that that it could be considered an expansion, and the concern was also voiced in the work group at their last meeting it went beyond just conveyance structures.
But only a couple of us were at the work group at that particular time. Okay. And a couple of places in here, the Madam Chair, the bill expands what we're doing in reporting of water usage, where statute already requires reporting on an annual basis. And this particular measure goes out to potentially a weekly or monthly or semi-annually.
Let's ask the department, since they had requested and said that they did not have the authority for watermasters to actually require reporting, so maybe you can
Could you help me
that?
Understand why we want to go to weekly instead of annual?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that the amendments throughout that talk about the commission may require reporting at any schedule that they set forth were intended to get at areas where, for example, in the work group, members of the Confederated Tribes talked about the Umatilla system, where our water master receives monthly reports of water use, and they use it to regulate both by duty and by rate. And so it was, I think the intent of these amendments was to give the commission more flexibility to require reporting more frequently than annually.
I want to be real careful here. You said by duty and rate?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct.
And what I want to be careful about is when you said rate, we're talking about rate of flow, not rate of any kind of payment.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. Rate of water diverted.
Okay. Okay, Madam Chair, I cease for here to open, let other people talk or...
All right, thank you. And I've already had some discussions with Debbie about this, so I appreciate you bringing up many of the things that we also discussed. Any other questions for Debbie before we pull up the last folks that were on the work group, and then we'll...
Madam Chair, if it's okay, I had just one other comment on the amendments. Under Section 12, where it talks about the date that the grant program... it would be repealed. One suggestion for the committee is that it coincide with the end of the biennium, that repeal date. And that would give us more time to work with water users and Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board on the cost share program.
And actually, Debbie, since we don't have a set date and statute for the end of the, I think the end of the biennium actually would be good. Either that or the end of the year, if we're talking about, on a fiscal year or calendar year, I think we need to be clear in how we're doing that.
I do have one more, if you can indulge me, Madam Chair.
Yeah, but I agree. I don't know where, we don't really know where that February 1st date came from. It just sort of appeared in the amendment. Representative Jensen?
Yeah, the other thing that I, I guess a little bit bothered by, or concerned about, not so much bothered by, In the bill and in the amendment, there's some reference to in-stream water right. When an in-stream water right is not met, or the waterway is...
Isn't that Section 9?
That would be Section 9, yes, Madam Chair. Or the waterway is designated as a state scenic waterway, or a federal wild and scenic river. As far as in-stream water rights at present time, probably most of them are junior water rights. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, I think that's typically they are more junior rights on a system.
And typically, all junior rights are... put on the back burner in times of shortage. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, that is correct. We would distribute by priority date.
Right. Given the language in here on that, I have some worry, Madam Chair, that this whole issue of doctrine of prior appropriation may get misconstrued by some folks when we start talking about in-stream water rights.
Okay. And Debbie, how would you, how would you interpret this as far as versus looking at a seniority versus a junior water right?
Madam Chair, I think this raises a very good question with the proposed language, and certainly it could be, as written, because an in-stream water right is not met, could be interpreted to be any time that even by priority date it's not met. I think it's a very good point with this proposed language.
Can maybe not here, Madam Chair, but can you and I and Debbie maybe have a word or two someplace before we get to that point?
We will do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jensen, clarification on that. And since we just got these amendments not too long ago, I appreciate Debbie, and I know you'll look forward to meeting with Representative Jensen and I to work these out.
Absolutely. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we're going to hear from, I think, other comments or similar comments from members of the work group. And I'm going to ask folks, because we do have a whole other hearing and a group of folks that are waiting, if you can limit your comments to 3 minutes, appreciate it. Jeff Stone, Anita Winkler, and Harlan Levy, if you could all come up together. And I'm just going to call up panels. It does not mean that you're necessarily associated with each other, but people get really worried about that when they're on camera being seen next to.
I would worry if I were her.
Say that. Anita, why don't you go ahead?
Madam Chair. If they think they have a problem, look at the problem you have when you have to be seen on camera.
Well, that's why we have you on that
that's
side.
That's why I'm so far away.
You notice that Representative Smith is to the far right of where I'm sitting. So
yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Chair Dinkfelder and members of the committee, I sort of hate to follow that exchange. And I don't have any concerns about being seen up here with Jeff Stone or anybody else.
I was going to say, I noticed you didn't mention Harlan.
Or anybody else. It was a spirited discussion at the work group that I think it was a series of discussions that needed to be had. I'm, for the record, Anita Winkler with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. Our members are by and large required to measure as just part of being districts and due to some other statute. So I'm not here to talk one way or the other about the validity of this bill and the meaning of it. But I do first off want to thank the chair and the work group, both the chair of the work group and the chair of the committee. And the members of the work group, we had had some concerns about the bill as introduced. And I want to thank you all that those concerns have, in fact, been addressed in the amendments that are before you today. Having said that, however, we have a couple of concerns with the language in front of you. First, about the workload on the department of implementing this, not a new program, but giving it a different kind of priority when you pass legislation as opposed to a commission policy. I have a couple of suggestions to resolve that are both fairly simple, I think. On page 2 of the dash 1 amendment, or the dash 2 amendments, section 2, subsection 2 in line 8, we would ask that you insert the word priority or and priorities following requirements. So the commission establishes requirements and priorities. Secondly, on line 9, add significant before the word diversion. And the intent of these is to provide a more focused program for the commission, a guidance from you to the commission, and information to all the rest of us who work on this that we know where the commission is headed in this program. Our second request is one that Representative Jensen already mentioned, is on page 5. It's 540.310, sections 1 and 2. We don't have any problem at all with changing the word ditch to conveyance system. In fact, we thought that was a good change. We do, however, have a bit of an issue of adding the or stream, which Representative Jensen already referred to. This is the section under which our districts function when they're measuring. And we just want to make sure that we wouldn't be held responsible for measuring the stream or the stream flow, but instead would be measuring what we're actually diverting. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'll get right to it. I appreciate the opportunity to testify to you today, and we have written testimony that goes into far more detail what my verbal comments are today. Nursery industry does believe that we should tackle Oregon's water data by obtaining information regarding actual stream flow, not just at the individual diversions. And one concern we have about this bill is it looks much more like a regulatory program than an information gathering initiative. A couple specific concerns. And first is what Anita mentioned, is the impact on the Water Resources Department staff. Second, in Section 5, the OAN cannot support this attempt to retroactively apply such an obligation on existing groundwater users throughout the state, or to drastically expand the department's regulatory authority in this manner. In Section 7, it establishes a new authority for a water master to shut down water uses diversion if that user fails to comply with water measurement reporting requirements. This is a pretty stringent enforcement mechanism. And fourth, Section 9 would expand the requirement to measure and provide water level data for surface and groundwater diversions to include areas throughout the state where, among other triggers, there are unresolved water user disputes and periods which in-stream water rights are not met. There are a lot of concerns we have about Section 9, which we've detailed in our letter to you. And I'd like to echo that we appreciate being invited to be part of this work group. And we pledge to you, Madam Chair, and to the members of this committee, that we want to work towards a comprehensive water supply policy that embraces conservation, supply, and the long-term plan to protect Oregon streams and water-dependent industries. Mm-hmm. So I thank you for your time this afternoon.
Great, thank you. And we do have your written comments. We appreciate that. Arlen.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I did want to clarify something. I was not technically on this work group. I did attend two of the hearings, but I was not on the 2564 work group.
And two of the meetings?
I went to two of the meetings, though. Sat in the back. I do have a couple of concerns, though, about this bill that I'd like to put on the record for you, referring to the Dash 2 amendments. And our issues generally surround the use of groundwater, specifically exempt wells. Those wells that are for domestic use are exempted under state law from the need to obtain a permit. There are a couple places within these Dash 2 amendments that exemption is going to be included. And Mr. Stone did mention it to you, but I did want to just put on the record our concerns as well. Section 5 is one of those sections could end up resulting in people that have exempt wells being subject to regulation. And then also, again, in Section 9, where it talks about in-stream water rights, giving the authority to the Water Resources Commission to require measurement devices on exempt wells. Those are two places that we are definitely concerned about in these amendments. With that, I will be happy to conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And I think there's a question from Representative Jensen.
Can I play the devil's advocate here?
Of course.
I want to know, when we get to critical groundwater areas, what do we do now in relationship to the exempt well principle? I mean, this is not a situation that is without some precedent in the state right now.
Is that for me?
Or for either or both?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Jensen, the commission already has authority to regulate in those areas, and we think that authority provides them with a lot of tools that they can use. In some cases, they can even go ahead and require permits for exempt wells. We think that they've already got the authority to deal with those situations.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, one of the overarching concerns that we have is when there is a problem in those ground critical areas, water can be shut off, regardless of if you have a senior water right or a junior water right. So, I mean, especially with a water-dependent industry such as the nursery industry, that's a big deal for us. And so when we deal with these overarching issues, especially with measurement and other issues that you'll be dealing with, we have to keep those things in mind.
And I just want to mention for the record that we will be dealing with this issue later this week when we hear the exempt groundwater bill that has also been amended. Just for the record, that is the amended version of the bill that will be coming out. But I appreciate you bringing that up because there is an interrelationship here between measurement and groundwater and the exempt well policy that we have on the books. Questions? Representative Kim?
Madam Chair, and maybe just to follow up on that and as a preview for later in the week and a question to think about, I guess I don't need a response now, but given that, and we've heard over and over again, that the department already has the authority in these critical groundwater areas to perhaps require measurement or even close down exempt wells, I guess I wonder what the problem is with clarifying that in statute, and particularly in the case of this bill, which only, which may not even do that, but you're suggesting you think it might. So that's a question just sort of hanging out there. Given that they already have the authority, what's the problem with saying that in statute?
Does anyone like to respond before I call up the next panel?
We'll have time on Friday to discuss this in depth, Representative King.
You need that long to think about it. Okay, we'll let you do that then.
I think slower than that is.
Yes. Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, we're just worried that you're opening the door to, you know, ultimately requiring measurement and removing the exemption entirely. That, you know, we see the problems in those specific areas of the state where there are aquifers that are not recharging, and we believe the commission already has the ability to deal with those situations. Once you start, you know, expanding the authority and creating new rationale and new reasons for them to do this, we just are worried about the exemption for domestic wells. That's been something that's been part of Oregon water law since we've had the water code. We're just worried that, you know, you're going to start moving 55. Away from this exemption, which again uses such a small and minimal amount of water. You're not going to be getting at the, you know, if there is a problem, the true problems are not going to be dealt with by going after exempt wells.
Well, I'm going to, since we're going to discuss this in great detail later in the week, and just clarification, 1955 is when the groundwater portion of our code came in. 1909 is actually our water code, but, you know, just a little clarification there. But I appreciate it. We'll have more discussion on this on Friday, and we have some other folks I'd like to call up from the work group. But and can you make sure, if you haven't already submitted your comments in writing, to do that as well? Do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. And some other folks who had signed up, Katie Fast, Richard Kosasan, and then I don't know if Jim Welch, did you want to come back? No. Hey, come on up. Couldn't remember. I think we had you down and didn't get a chance to get to you. Hey, thank you, Katie. Why don't you go
Hi.
Ahead and start?
Really good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. First, I think it's been made clear by previous panelists that, you know, the drafts of amendments that come forward are not a consensus project of the work group, and Oregon Farm Bureau does not agree with what we see as the intent of the legislation, which is we're assuming is to endorse the department strategy in statute. Water Resources Department already has the authority to implement their measurement strategy, and from our perspective, we don't need to see a need to duplicate that authority. However, our concern goes greater into the legislation, as it's much broader than the statutes or the department's current authority. And some examples of that have already been addressed in section, but to give them some idea of the committee, in Section 2, it allows measurement of basins where there is a potential for flow restoration. In the work group, it came forward that could be any basin could be seen as a potential for flow restoration. In Section 9, the in-stream water right that is not met is also a grave concern for my association, as well as measurement in scenic waterways and federal wild and scenic rivers. We see, as the Dash 2s go forward, this would be a statewide measurement strategy, not a significant diversion and priority basin strategy as the Water Resources Department has currently. Also, we have concerns with the emphasis on reporting. The Water Resources Department is a short-staffed agency, and we have concerns with their ability to handle additional workload. Through the work group meetings, accuracy of measurement devices was also talked about and discussed. I have members who are taking measurement devices off of their groundwater diversions because they're finding that they can do the calculations on their sprinkler systems to a much higher accuracy level than their gauges. So when we get to the question of why the state would implement a statewide strategy, Farm Bureau sees some value when it comes to data collection, information for state planning, but accuracy is a large concern of that. And we would endorse taking a step back, looking at why we're looking at measurement, and how we can address a statewide strategy that's looking at stream gauges for getting a collection of data on what's going on in our basins, along with additional groundwater studies being done by the department, and we endorse those in the water resources budget. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Also, there's several other organizations that have concerns with the legislation moving forward. Cascade Policy Institute, Pulp and Paper Association, Manufactured Housing of Oregon, Northwest Christmas Tree Growers, Oregon Agricultural Alliance, Oregon Groundwater Association, the Home Builders Association, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, Oregonians in Action, Associated Loggers, and Oregon Forest Industries Council, along with Oregon sheep growers who are not testifying today.
Okay, Mr. Kosasan, or Mr. Welsh, whoever wants to go first. I'm going to have to ask you to limit your testimony to 2 minutes. We're really running out of time.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh of the Oregon Cattlemen Association. Let's let Richard do the cleanup here. There's a lot of concerns that we agree with, certainly with the testimony you've heard. And to the two-year amendments here, we have been looking for, with your requests, for trying to find consensus, and I know that in our work group we have not. We're looking for how the public and certainly the producers in the state are best served. And we have not found anything special within the amendments. We feel that the commission and the department have the authority they need. And when we look at the preamble, we're looking for a problem statement, and we're not finding one here. Maybe the very last one, where it says, whereas there is a need for State of Oregon to establish a program to share in the cost of installing measurement devices now, you know, and maybe that the funding part of this for the Water Resources Department is the problem statement. Not sure, but when you look at section 2 through 9, we still feel that for the most part the department and the commission definitely have the authority to take these on. So we're not doing anything special in this. And when you get to section 10, we again think that Oregon Water Shed Enhancement Board and the Water Resource Department working together and said they, in testimony, we've heard that they have done that. Well, if there's more money needed, then that should be specific. And if it is, then needs goes Ways and Means. And we think that this there should be a referral to Ways and Means to take care of that section. So those are our concerns. We have stated many in the past, and we think that what they're doing right now, certainly with their program that they're implementing right now, it's good. And another one, we have talked about the Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. We support that, too. So I think they've got everything on track.
And Mr. Kosasan?
Thank
you, Madam.
We've
got 2 minutes, and we are going to wrap up. I think we have one more speaker.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Richard Kosasan, Water for Life. We will echo quite a few of the previous comments and believe that the draft language embodied in 2564-2 probably could be clarified to a certain degree. Specific comments would include the loss of provisions contained in sections 10 and 11, specifically with respect to the funding mechanism, we believe rather than initiate a new funding mechanism, we should perhaps look at the existing water measurement cost share program, the revolving fund that exists in statute right now. That might be a solution. But to suggest that we're going to set up a funding mechanism for a period of 2 years, to me, this is a long-term endeavor, and if it is a long-term endeavor, the funding mechanism should continue. As drafted, again, we believe that the language contained in the proposed amendments is somewhat prescriptive in manner. With respect to the program, again, the funding mechanism, to me, has a very large question mark over the top of it. Language contained in Sections 2 and 9, dealing with flow restoration and in-stream rights, federal wild and scenic flows, I think, could be clarified. As a point of interest, about 6 years ago, we did a study in terms of in-stream rights and found that a majority of the requests by one of the requesting agency for in-stream rights, the amount of water requested was in exceedance of what was in the stream in its natural pristine condition. So when we add that into the equation, when you condition actions on, quote, an in-stream water right, I think that poses many questions and many problems. And with that, Madam Chair, I hope that's 2 minutes.
Great, thank you. Any quick questions for this panel before we move on to the last witness? Okay, thank you very much for coming back. Appreciate it. And the last person we have up is Dave Moskowitz and Kimberly, oh, two people, Kimberly Priestley. Okay.
Chair Dingfeld and members of the committee, my name is Kimberly Priestley. I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon, and with me is Dave Moskowitz. First of all, I just wanted to take a quick moment to thank the Chair Dingfelder and Representative Jensen on pulling the work group together and for all of their hard work on this issue. I was just going to touch on a couple points that were raised in the preceding testimony. First of all, you know, we're hearing a lot of comments that this is putting more regulation on folks and it's unnecessary regulation. And I guess I would just remind the committee that for the most part, this is all permissive language. And I think for the benefit of the rest of the committee, Representative Jensen and Dingfelder are aware of this. Water Watch really wanted, we were really pushing for a bill that put in statute requirements. And this bill does not do that. So, you know, that's, I guess I just want to make the point that it is, in fact, permissive. And as Debbie said, it's giving the commission, who everyone here seems to be applauding, more just the flexibility to do what they need to do. And there was also a lot of discussion about sort of the broadening of their authority. Again, that's just granting them some flexibility that we think they actually, that, you know, would be helpful in their broader management purposes. I also would like to note that the broadening also included the cost share stuff, because the commission's 2000 directive did not have anything in there about cost share, and so this provision is actually of great benefit to the users, and I think that's very important to note. On the in-stream water right question that Representative Jensen raised, we would not see that as a sort of an attempt to get at the priority dates of in-stream water rights. However, you know, hearing a lot of concern about that specific language, we are very willing to work with folks on changing the language. I think the SWMPA statutes are quite broad, so it's not the key provision of these amendments. So I think the concerns there could be addressed rather easily. And I believe those were just our main responses to folks. If anyone has any questions.
Thank you. I'll let David go first, and then we'll see if there's any questions before we wrap up.
Chair Dingfeld, I don't have any other remarks to make, and I'm happy to help answer questions if necessary. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions?
I just appreciate the comment about the in-stream water right issue to clarify that. That's very nice and very helpful. Thank you.
Anything else? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you all coming back today. Apologize about running out of time last week. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2564. And now I'm going to open up a public hearing on, give time for Beth to sneak out.
Musical chairs.
Yes, the musical staff here will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3500. And Pat, could you please provide us with an overview?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3500 modifies pollution control facility tax credit and extends the period for which facilities may be certified for tax credit if facilities constitute enhanced pollution control facilities. It requires pollution control facility owners to report on continued operation and effectiveness of the facilities. Now, the committee, you have before you in the dais a -1 amendment that was submitted today by the Oregon Business Association, and I will defer to somebody from OBA to describe the amendment.
Okay, great. I'm going to ask Lisa Dotto to come up and Lynn Lundquist. Come here.
Representative Dinkfelder and committee, we appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to you today, and we are also going to invite Jim Roger from AOI to join us, if that is all right with you. My name is Lisa Adato, and I'm with the Oregon Business Association, and we are here in support of House Bill 3500. About a year ago, we were approached by individuals from the business community and individuals from the environmental community, and the discussion centered on the pollution control tax credit bill and how it had become a polarizing and partisan issue. Individuals from both the business and the environmental community felt that it was an important bill, but it needed to be modernized, and they recommended that this would be a good issue for the Oregon Business Association, since it is our role to look for nonpartisan or bipartisan compromise solutions to these kinds of issues. And the OBA spent many months working with users of the bill and members of the environmental community to find a compromise solution. And what we present to you today is a result of months of work and negotiation. It is a hybrid solution with a base tax credit linked to an enhanced credit that gives a bigger benefit to companies that go above and beyond Oregon requirements. We believe that if this bill is enacted into law, it creates numerous benefits for Oregon, including environmental benefits. This bill will stimulate business to go above and beyond the law in protecting Oregon's environment. Development of new practices to enhance sustainability. This law rewards those pioneer companies who are inventing and investing in new ways to create products and services that reduce pollution, replace toxic materials, reduce waste, and reduce carbon use. As these new practices are developed, Oregon's pioneer companies can export new technologies to other states. We believe that this will create and maintain a partnership between the environmental community and the business community. Many in the business community are proud of their role in environmental protection. The tax credit rewards innovation in this area. Economic benefits. In some cases, companies will not be able to stay in Oregon if they're required to meet environmental laws that go significantly beyond those in other states. This law would allow Oregon to pass the kind of laws we need to meet our state's environmental goals while maintaining businesses that are vital to our communities. And finally, this will promote Oregon's competitive advantage as a leader in sustainable practices. Oregon has determined that it will compete against other states as a leader, and this is our business plan, as I've noted in other testimony before this committee. This bill will encourage companies throughout Oregon to experiment and pioneer with new practices. And these techniques will leverage research dollars that we're spending at our universities to find new bioproducts and other techniques, and we'll be able to attract new companies and jobs to Oregon. And our current companies will be able to export these new technologies and increase their profitability. All Oregonians will eventually benefit from the successful implementation of this strategy. And we've seen that repeatedly with new companies coming to Oregon and new jobs. The concept of the EETC is to create a hybrid that gives companies a tax credit for activities that substantially reduce or eliminate pollution or create new procedures that reduce a company's environmental footprint. There's two pieces of this hybrid. One is the base pollution control piece, and this is defined as pollution control facility that allows a company to exceed federal standards. So those standards that Oregon has enacted that go above and beyond federal law will give a tax credit to companies that are in the delta between federal standards and Oregon law. And the other piece of this is the enhanced environmental piece. And the enhanced pieces are defined as activities that go above and beyond state or local regulation or include an environmental management plan that guides a company to reduce or eliminate pollution through the employment of new procedures, technologies, or materials. So this is not just a facility or a capital cost, but an operational cost to create a new environmental management plan. Also included in this are activities that reduce carbon emissions by 40% or 1,000 tons. And you can see in the picture that I presented to you that there's different credits for the base pollution control and the enhanced control that change over time. This is designed to become revenue neutral, and that will not exceed the cost of the previous PCTC. It will begin in year 2008, and the state of Oregon will not incur additional costs in the new biennium. The bill will sunset in 2014. During this session, we've seen a huge interest in the development of renewable energy and recycling, and the OBA has been an active player and supporter of these initiatives, and we applaud the legislature for being proactive in this important fight to reduce greenhouse gases while creating new economic opportunities for Oregon. We believe that the EETC is a necessary complement to these activities. While energy and recycling deserve our passionate attention, we should not forget that throughout Oregon there are a plethora of companies that are manufacturing goods and producing services. Throughout these industries, some new and some traditional, there are many changes that can and should be made to reduce our environmental footprint, and we urge you to pass the EETC bill to address these needs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Lynn, John?
John. Representative Cannon, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, AOI. And we're very pleased to see this bill. There were actually several of these types of bills at the beginning of the session. There was one sponsored by Representative Boone. There's one sponsored by Senator Bates. And we looked at this bill, and we like this bill. And the amendments you do have some amendments. And there are a couple of things that are missing from the amendments that I thought I'd touch on because we're going to have to go back down. One is that the DEQ does need authority to levy an additional fee to recoup their costs of rulemaking, because whenever you do something like this, they have to make rules, and there needs to be something in the amendments that gives them the ability to do a surcharge to recoup their rulemaking costs. And another thing that is part of this bill, it goes back to when I was listening to the director of the DEQ testify about her groundwater program, which is a very important program, but she had no way to fund it. And what this bill does is a little innovative, but it's sort of like a mutual fund that you would buy if it had a load. And that is when you get the credit, when the credit is awarded to you by the EQC, essentially to get the credit, you have to pay a fee of 1.5%, a load. And that load goes into a special account for groundwater protection activities for the DEQ. So it is used to fund an important DEQ program that otherwise simply wouldn't get funded because it has no way to get money. It has no permitting base. So it does supply a source of revenue that would grow over time. It would take a little while for it to pick up. And also it would reimburse the agency for any fees that it would take to run the program. So we think this is a good program. It's not nearly as broad as the old one. A lot of things came out of the old one, like credits for noise, the infamous chippers, Although there, you can still get it for a very large chipper, like over 100 horsepower, but not for any of the friendly little chippers like you saw in the movie Fargo. You know, those are out. And also, it's not wide open for anything you get. If all you do is meet federal minimums, if there's a federal number and all you do is get meet federal minimums, you can't get the credit, which is different than it was before. So it's quite a bit tighter. There's a lot of authority given to the DEQ to interpret the rules and develop rules. We think this will be a big help, especially, frankly, we don't want to see more operations move to Mexico. We're worried about that. We'd like to see companies perform well here and stay here. Thank you.
Thank you. Lynn?
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for inviting us here today. First of all, I'd just like to say thank you for giving us a hearing on this bill. We will understand that it is a bill that has had a colorful past. But we also believe that it's an opportunity to continue those elements of that process and of those factions have been going on over time in regard to pollution control. And let's be innovative. And that's what this bill is all about. It allows the businesses to be innovative and reward them for that. Give them an incentive to do that. Too many times, I think we tend to use the stick instead of the carrot in order to make things happen. And this is an opportunity to actually give them an incentive to bring forth those processes as well as capital expenditures that Lisa was talking about, which broadens the aspect of allowing businesses to be innovative in that. It gives them an opportunity to have a credit through that process. And I think that's important because we're talking about innovation here in a way that hasn't been done before. So it's new things. It goes above and beyond the pollution regulations that we have. And so this is simply an attempt to bring this to up to what I'd say the 21st century. I'm very pleased to sit here with AOI and OBA together. We've worked hard in putting this into a compromise, into a viable alternative for the pollution control within this state. As Madam Chair, you obviously have been a leader in the whole renewables and in that endeavor and what it's trying to do for the pollution of this state. This is another mechanism to attack that. It's a little different than renewables per se, but it's part of the total mix. I always think, you know, coming from Eastern Oregon or Central Oregon, one size doesn't fit all, whether it's in land use or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And certainly here is an opportunity, I believe, to reach out to the business community and have a very viable program. Unfortunately, the incoming chairman of the OBA, who's with Collins Pine, who some of you are familiar with, couldn't be here today, but he could speak very eloquently about the need to have this as we try to compete with states around us. He has processes in eastern and southern Oregon. So again, thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing us to have this presentation today, and we look forward to continue this on to a work session, hopefully.
Thank you, and I apologize for missing part of the testimony, but I have your written testimony here, and one question I had is on page 3 where you, and I realize this is not the Revenue Committee, but I still think it's important for us to get a sense, since we also heard, you know, House Bill 2210 and the 2211 and 12, that this bill is designed to be revenue neutral and it won't exceed the cost of the previous pollution control tax credit. So for some of us who have been around a while, we have some new members. I think it would be of interest to talk about what in the past the costs have been and how this is revenue neutral, I'm sort of assuming, because you're sunsetting the base PCTC and then it's increasing the environmental enhancement tax credit. So sort of one goes down, the other goes up. But can you identify for us what that biennial costs are projected to be?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the amendments, it changes a little bit. The base does go down, but not as much. But it's tightened up.
The shorter time frame?
No, you can only get it if you exceed federal.
So it's okay.
So it's more narrow.
Narrow scope.
I actually went back to 20 years and I normalized the tax credits. It used to be 50%. You got it for anything. I stripped out all the chippers. I stripped out most of the noise. I normalized them to 35%. And the old system, it gyrated wildly, but the liability was, I think, around $24 million a year liability.
Year or biennium?
I'd have to check.
Is it, I thought was it was biennium.
Well, biennium, a biennium. And, but about half of that was actually cashed in. Maybe $16 million was actually cashed in. Because companies may not make any money, or they might go out of business. This would be, because you've reduced it from 50%, which was the old one, to 35, and you strip out all the chippers, and you take out anything that doesn't meet federal standards, I would guess it would be, it would probably be around 13, maybe.
A biennium.
Yeah, but you don't get there for 10 years. And the reason for that is this. The way the credit works, which is a little unusual, this isn't a credit that you get up front and then you promise to do something. The way this credit works is like this. After the first of next year, if you commence construction on something, you have to plan, you have to find a place, you commence construction, then on average it might take you 2 or 3 years to build. Once it's up and finished and going, then you can apply for the credit. Then it takes about a year to get the credit awarded, and then you can apply it to taxes. So the first series of facilities we'll see getting this credit will be ones that commence construction after the first of next year, finish construction, do the application, which is complicated, get it approved by DEQ, and get the award, and then file. So that will be the 07. And when they file, they only get 10% of that credit for that year. So if it was for $100,000, they're going to get that first group next year will get $10,000 about 4 years out. And then the next year, there'll be another cohort come on, you know, for 08, and it'll be 5 or 6 years before they get their amount. So the total impact on the budget goes up very slowly, and it takes about 10 years before you reach full.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I add to that, too? John was talking about the capital, the issues related to capital costs. We've also added to the credit a credit for management costs to create a management plan for, but we have, and I'd just like to direct your attention to the amendments where we have placed dollar limits on those credits.
What section was that in again, just so for the committee's
sake?
It's
page 17 of the amendments, and you can see that we have placed dollar limits on those credits based on the size of the company.
And the other thing is all the old credits that were issued in the past that you can take over 10 or 13 years, those continue to roll through. This doesn't cut off the old credits that were issued. So you have kind of an overlap, which is one of the things that needs to get fixed. But the fiscal impact from this measure is a ways out, and it'll grow very slowly.
One last question I had is, how does this compare to other states? I didn't have a chance to get on NCSL and see what other states have, but that would be, I think, helpful for the committee is to see what other states have and where this fits in with other state policies.
Other states, their credits range from, it's not even related to pollution control, you just build, you get a huge credit, to fairly narrow like this is, which is a pretty narrow pollution control tax credit. One of the things I might mention is, as you know, the base on this is if you go beyond federal. You have to go beyond federal. If all you hit is the federal number, you don't get it. These are states that have some type of federal stringency language that says it's illegal to go beyond federal in your state. These are who we're competing against. It's Tennessee, Kentucky, Alaska, Wisconsin, Florida, Oklahoma, Indiana, Ohio, North Carolina, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, Virginia, Idaho, Mississippi, and, of course, Mexico and China. And so those are states that have some type, broad or narrow, of limitation where the agency cannot be more strict than federal no matter what. And in Oregon, you know, we don't have that or it's very rare. And what we're saying is because if all you hit is federal, you know, you're on the same playing field as everybody else. You don't get a credit. But if you go beyond federal, then you do. And that's our competition.
Right. Any other questions for the panel? Representative Pearson.
Yeah, thank you. I'll throw this out to the panel. I'm trying to understand the the 50% level, the environmental enhancement tax credit, which is for going beyond, if I'm following it right, any regulatory standard. So how obviously there are policy choices then in which technologies will be embraced and then will be whatever it's embraced then would qualify for the credit. How is that managed? Is it open to the business to decide what that will be, unlike a situation where you're getting a credit for complying with a regulatory standard that's been set by somebody, whether it's the state or the federal government?
Yes, it would be up to a business, and part of our intent here is to create innovation in businesses, and we'll have some testimony from innovative businesses that are doing that, just that. But for a business that goes above and beyond any state or local regulation, they will have to show that they've demonstrated substantial reduction or elimination of pollution in their application. But it will be part of their business strategy to determine how they do that.
Follow up, if I could.
Follow up.
But what's to determine what is pollution? I mean, if somebody were to, business were to decide that substance or agent that nobody else thinks is a problem, they think is a problem because they've got a great solution for dealing with it and they want to abate it and then get a 50% tax credit. What's to prevent somebody from dreaming up their own problem and then their own solution?
Well, they won't just be dreaming it up in a vacuum, of course. They'll be going through the process that many have gone through with the EQC and at the DEQ, and they'll be looking at existing statutes.
I can tell you from experience with this, there are absolutely Byzantine rules, complicated rules, that would make your lawyer's heart glow on how this thing is implemented. And one of the things that we put in the amendments very clearly was very clear direction to the EQC, DEQ, to adopt rules on what qualifies, what doesn't, and how it's interpreted. And we also pay for that to be done through a surcharge, because they have to do, you have to have guidelines. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing engineers and the lawyers figure out like we have now. And it will take a while to do, and it is tricky.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think Representative Jensen has a question.
Oh,
he was just playing with the chair over here.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much for coming up. Appreciate it. And we have the next panel, which is Robert Grott, Steve Gunther, and Catherine Vanetta.
Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, I'll try to not overlap too much with my previous speakers. My name is Robert Grott. I'm Executive Director of the Northwest Environmental Business Council. And for background, NEBC is a trade association representing firms making a living in the environmental sector. We have about 160 member companies in Northwest, including engineers, consultants, contractors, lawyers, and technology providers in every sector, including air, water, soil, waste, and energy. And NEBC has been working on this environmental enhancement tax credit bill for a year now, and we sincerely appreciate that it is coming to a hearing before this committee. I'll be honest with you, NEBC members make a living working on environmental and energy projects, and this bill helps their businesses. But at the core, our members do care sincerely about the health of the environment and of Oregon, and that's largely why I'm here. We see the environmental enhancement bill as a replacement for the old broken PCTC and its many flaws, and together with the Oregon Business Association and now AOI, we've talked extensively with environmental specialists, regulators, environmental organizations, and yes, the businesses that are regulated. And we believe this bill with its beyond compliance approach is a good one. And let me again touch on the highlights. Again, it goes beyond federal requirements, has been spoken, and has a higher tax credit for the going beyond and above state and local requirements. And let me reiterate, in a dramatic departure from the PCTC, this bill promotes changes in the way a company does business. There's a tax credit that covers part of the cost for doing a study of how a company can improve its environmental performance, and then there's an additional credit for the process changes that are involved in pollution reduction that come from that study. And so this, again, encourages companies to rethink how their approach to compliance. A few more provisions. Carbon dioxide we list in this bill as a pollutant to be reduced. As John mentioned, 1.5% of the credit would be withheld and go into a fund administered by DEQ to pay for groundwater protection programs, which are now not funded. Also, I want to add something wasn't mentioned yet, is that this tax is transferable. This will allow cities and counties and new entrepreneurial companies without a tax liability to sell their credit, thereby helping them as well invest in pollution reduction. I'm fully aware that the political and tax climate this committee and the House and the entire legislature is working under this year. And so clearly the attention and the budget for tax credits is going to renewable energy. We're not against that. I mean, many of our members work in energy, and in fact, NEBC is now the host for the new Northwest Biofuels Association trade group, and in fact, we're holding a major energy conference up in Portland tomorrow. But this is the Energy and Environment Committee. I disagree personally with the concept that all tax credit funds should suddenly shift to renewable energy as if our work in protecting the environment is done. Renewable energy is a greenhouse gas issue, it's an energy security issue, a rural economic development issue, we all agree, but clean air, clean water, and waste reductions are also quality of life, sustainability, and economic development issues. And we've talked about the funding. We're looking at no impact in the upcoming biennium. And I will add that we can also consider cost caps if that's would limit the size and budget exposure of an ETC program. So, yes, many are happy to see the old PCTC disappear into the sunset, but the EETC, we say, is our chance to continue Oregon's leadership and support of environment and our industrial base. Thank you.
Thank you. Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager, Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. Chair Dingfelter, members of the committee. The pulp and paper industry has been a large user of the pollution control tax credit in the past. We were once the largest manufacturing sector in the wood products industry in the state, and we did use the credit, and we used it to do wonderful things like switch to recycling. Like we have mills that just do all recycled furnish in this state. We're a net importer of recycled furnish for our mills in this state, importing from places like California. And one thing that you have heard is that this credit has changed. It's new, it's different, it goes beyond, and it adds things like working on carbon dioxide. And it takes the best of the type of things that we're trying to do this session and incents some of the manufacturing base that might not otherwise be involved in some of the innovative things we're trying to do and gives them something. We've heard a lot about moving markets in this committee and this session and trying to incent things that we want to do. My pitch to you is that this is something for your large manufacturing base that uses your energy, that can help you get to where you're going, and we would wish that you would look upon it favorably, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelter and members of the committee. My name's Steve Gunther, and I'm with an Oregon company called Oil Re-Refining Company. We're a Northwest leader in recycling, and we're based here in Portland, but we work throughout the Northwest. And I'm here to ask your passage for this measure on behalf of businesses like mine, which is a small business, even though we have a large footprint and we have a pretty big impact on the recycling business. We employ fewer than 100 people at family wage jobs, And we believe this measure would allow us to grow and hire even more Oregonians. Secondly, it relates to other small businesses that we work with. It's pretty straightforward. Everyone who gets an oil change is a generator of that oily waste and those oil filters. And millions of oil filters end up in the landfills every year. Most of the large chains of Jiffy Lubes and Quick Lubes and large trucking companies already recognizing the potential liability from throwing oil filters, which still have oil in them, into landfills, are recycling these. They're going above and beyond the call. This tax credit, if it's extended for those who would go beyond compliance and who would invest in filter crushers, and this is a real glamorous topic, so I get excited talking about it every time. If you'll crush your oil filter, then you can get, you know, 500 of those filters into a barrel versus 200, and therefore you can reduce the cost of that service. I take my car to Chuck and Janet Beaupre, and if I were to offer them a filter crusher for $1,000, telling them that they could get, you know, 500 of that back, that would make a difference to them. They'd be able to pay for that piece of equipment that would add value to their shop. They'd be able to pay for that in a couple of years. So it will have a positive impact on small businesses throughout the state, including oil re-refining company and our customers.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Smith and Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure, sir, if you're the individual that asked this. Maybe it's AOI. I'm struggling with the tax credit. What's the difference between a tax credit and just expensing it out on your tax return?
This would actually, as I understand it, it would reduce their tax burden, or actually, if they had a refund, if they were due a refund of $100 and they had spent $200 on this piece of equipment, then that 50% tax credit in the whatever course of time it took for them to get it back would give them an extra $100 back toward their business.
So just a follow-up, and I kind of see heads out there. So is this in addition to your expense on your Schedule E or Schedule C?
I don't know if it'd be an expense if you bought an asset for your business.
Well, sure. I mean, if I go and I purchase a piece of equipment, I can depreciate the equipment I expense on my Schedule E or C. And so I'm curious if this tax credit is an addition to that. If not, I'm trying to figure out the benefit to the business because I can already expense it.
Yes, it is.
Yes. It is my understanding.
Maybe
anybody
someone afterwards
wanna?
Could come track me down. And
I see a lot of nodding heads. Lynn, do you want to come up and address that? Question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Smith, on a tax credit, that comes off taxes owed. On the other ways, it's just just a reduction of your taxable income.
Perfect. Thank you. That answers my question.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and the final panel, or a couple of folks, is Joan Snyder and Liz Frankel. I shouldn't say panel because you guys didn't sign up together. Just happened to be the last ones on the list.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Joan Snyder. I'm an attorney practicing in Portland in the area of environmental, natural resources, and health safety law, which I've done for 20 years. And I'm here to testify in favor of this bill because I think it's absolutely essential to continuing environmental innovation in Oregon. And I think there's two reasons why this bill is important. One is because it will raise the level of environmental protection that we're providing to the citizens of the state. But the second is that it has the potential to make Oregon an innovator compared to other states in the area of environmental technologies. And we have, I guess the question I've been getting most constantly is, why do we need this bill this session? Because I know you have a lot of other things going on, and I know we care deeply about the renewable energy credits as well. But the reason is because the whole field of environmental technology and environmental services is changing, both in our state, nationally, and globally. And if we want the business sector in Oregon to be ready to develop the innovative environmental tools that will be used throughout the world, then we need to give them an incentive to do that and give them a market to do that. So what this bill will do is for Oregon businesses like CH2M Hill and wastewater, Stormwater 360, which are already businesses that, that are at the very cusp of the environmental innovation market, give them a greater market for their goods so that they can develop new technologies which can then ultimately be exported to different states. So in Oregon right now, we have 152 environmental consulting firms that just do environmental consulting or technology development. We have many, many more cross-sector businesses that support that industry, make pumps, make measuring equipment, all the kinds of things that support that industry. And if we get on the head of the curve and say, we're going to create an incentive so that businesses in Oregon will want to buy your environmentally innovative products, then we will be developing a business sector that can multiply and that can bring benefits to the state. And, Madam Chair, you asked the question about what other states are doing. And I looked at that probably about 6 months ago. No one has a program that's exactly like this. As Mr. Ledger said, there are states that give tax credits for doing and pollution control was what we used to do, and that's our competition. But if we get out in front and say that the main focus of our tax incentive program is on innovative technologies that go beyond compliance, then we'll be taking a step that I would hope would put us ahead of the curve for that competitive industry, so not as in other sectors where I always feel like we're trying to catch up, that there are other states, North Carolina, Massachusetts, that have heavily invested in technology development. If Oregon is the one that gets out in front by having an innovative idea that's just a little bit different than what other states are doing, then we can be building that industry sector in a way that will benefit the entire state for many years to come.
Thank you. And I apologize, by the way, Stephen, is it Roger? Why don't you come up on the third chair, because I somehow thought you already crossed off and you weren't, and want to make sure we have time for you. Liz?
I feel somehow or other as though I ought to go out and get my black hat and put it on. First of all, I better say for the record, I'm Liz Frankel, League of Women Voters. The League of Women Voters of Oregon is a grassroots, nonpartisan, statewide political organization which encourages informed citizen participation in government. Having said that, I'm going to ad lib for the moment. I'll give you my testimony later, but that's kind of irrelevant to what I want to say. The League does not support this bill. Mm-hmm. And first of all, I want to say there are some wonderful news in this bill. The acknowledgement that stringency requirements are kind of foolish, which is Oregon has water requirements that exceed federal standards. We have lots of things. The stringency requirement that says you shouldn't go over, exceed federal requirements isn't very Oregonian. That's wonderful, and I heard that said publicly in the testimony, and I like that. But the problem that League faces, we have already said we didn't support 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bills that had hearings that had to do with tax expenditures. The League has great concerns that the whole issue of tax expenditures and the revenue lost, and I'll address that in a moment to this bill specifically, but that loss of revenue is important to a state that is trying to develop a stable system. Actually, in this bill, one of the things that was said in answer to Representative McPherson's question and a couple of other questions, I guess it was the chair's question, and that is, how much is this really revenue neutral? The answer came back not very clearly. It was, if you assume a certain amount of loss, if you assume that your not everybody is going to pick up the credit and so on. But this isn't a real stable foundation. What the League would like to see, and this would include the wonderful M&Ms that went to the energy industry this session in terms of tax credits, we'd like to see all of this looked at a single time so that it's fair and accountable. In other words, the League would support certain, we're not looking at the merits of this particular measure. We're looking at the whole issue of tax expenditures and the funds, the revenue lost. We're simply saying that we'd like to have a review of all of the tax expenditures on a level with a level playing ground, level playing field, so that we know how much the state loses in revenue. And if we set up criteria, we can say this is good, that isn't good in terms of the public interest.
Thank you, Liz.
That's it?
Okay, great. Thanks. So we have enough time for one more, and then we're going to wrap up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Stephen Rogers, Vice President of Technology of Lean Path Incorporated, and here in support of this tax credit. Lean Path is a three-year-old Portland-based technology consulting company that is focused on hospitality and the food service industry. And we provide tools and training that help people waste less food in large-scale kitchen operations. And large-scale kitchen operations do waste a large amount of food. We often see as much as 25% of the total purchased food being prepared and never served in our customers. Our system helps customers reduce this pre-consumer food waste by as much as 50% by giving them a way to easily measure what they're wasting, to understand it in detail, and then use a variety of techniques to achieve the waste reductions. And obviously this can save a lot of money in the high-volume organizations, and our typical customer spends over $1 million per year on food for every site. This also represents a large amount of solid waste that's generated and dumped into landfills. So reducing food waste also represents a large potential improvement in sustainability for our customers. And many of them are concerned, increasingly so, about improving their company's sustainable practices. In our experience, most businesses are large and small, want to do the right thing and operate in more sustainable manner. Many are discovering that running a sustainable business doesn't mean running a less profitable business. Indeed, you can save money and be green at the same time, and efficiency usually aligns quite nicely with profitability. So if this is the case, then why doesn't everyone intuitively end up doing what's both best for their business and the environment? In many cases, it's a simple matter of knowledge, i.e. how do we do it? It's also a matter of risk, and this is where we get into this bill. To get to the point where the actual savings are being realized, investments need to be made in programs like ours, for example. And when companies are taking on these types of waste reduction initiatives for the first time, they don't really know how much progress is possible. So they perceive it as a risk to invest in sustainability. This is a big factor that slows down the incorporation of innovative practices in established businesses. However, these same businesses would be much more likely to set bigger goals for environmental improvement faster than they otherwise would if there were less financial risk and greater certainty of the outcomes. So this environmental enhancement tax credit would have a positive effect in encouraging hesitant firms by reducing the risk that their sustainability investments would make a negative impact on their bottom line. So it would increase businesses' ability to make investments in sustainability that would benefit Oregon's environment, its livability, and ultimately lead to financially healthier Oregon firms that would be capable, better capable of continuing to invest. So as a secondary point that's been mentioned earlier, Oregon hopes to be a state that invents sustainability ideas, products, and services that will make a difference nationally and internationally. If we are thought to be thought leaders in the commercial sector, we should strive for the same in public policy, establishing a forward-thinking tax credit that other states would want to follow. So if we start a wave, this will help Oregon businesses such as ours, Lean Path, as we export our leading-edge sustainability expertise and products to other regions that use similar tax credits to enhance demand for those kind of sustainable solutions. But first, we need to prime the pump, and this is a great way to do it, in our opinion. So thank you.
Thank you. I think Representative Jensen had a question or comment, and then Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To all of the members that have testified here on behalf of House Bill 3500, I would have a question. And that question is one I've asked many times in this legislature. How many teachers is this costing us? How many teachers are we spending to come up with these tax credits? Because this is taking money out of the general fund and putting it out in the form of tax credits. I can understand sometimes you need to prime the pump. But as Ms. Snyder's testimony tells me, we've got 152 in 2003, 152 environmental consulting businesses in Oregon, and 621 individuals. And some of the companies involved are companies with nationwide reputations, and there are several cited. The industry is viable. What does it need all the tax credits for? I've watched tax credits come through this building for six sessions now. And there is one thing that's kind of interesting about this one, these tax credits this time. These are taking on the appearances of bipartisan. We're appealing to one party to get tax credits on the rationale or basis of environmental. And then we're appealing to the other party, which typically represents industry and business, on the basis of tax credits and quote-unquote economic development. Madam Chair, I remain, as I have always, pessimistic of tax credits. And I do this for some pretty good reason. For about 10 years, I owned and operated a company that took full and total advantage of tax credits. We went to industries from the top retail companies in the United States, a company like Sears, Kmart, and sold them a service to help them collect tax credits. And they collected billions of dollars worth of federal tax credits. And the only thing that was positive about it was their bottom line increased and mine increased. Mine and a few other people that were involved in that. I fail to see, Madam Chair, the benefits of tax credits, though I am heartened with a bipartisan tax credit programs that we're dealing with this time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. And Representative Jensen, Representative Smith, did you want to add anything quickly since we're about to be kicked out by the Transportation Committee?
Thanks for letting me follow that. never in a million years am I going to intellectually joust the good representative for Pendleton, because I'd get whooped every time. The one comment I have, though, very quickly, and I've heard this theme throughout the day, I think the business community and the Environment Committee have failed business in Oregon by talking about energy efficiency as an expense. I don't think energy efficiency is an expense. I actually think it's a secondary source of revenue to a business. It's lost revenue that they're going to be able to capture over a long term. And the statement was made earlier by somebody in here talking that businesses do view this as an expense. And I think if you can change that thinking to help them realize this is a way to enhance their bottom line, which increases income taxes into the state of Oregon over the long term, that everyone does benefit. And so I think there's two approaches or two different views on this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for sharing those comments. And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3500. Since we got through everything today, we will no longer need to have a hearing tonight, so you guys are off the hook.
I was off the hook anyway, because I already have a meeting.
And I will close the House Energy and Environment Committee.